Welcome to the Hinckley Institute of Politics. My name is Lindsay Clauston, and I will be the host for today's Hinckley Forum. The Hinckley Institute of Politics was established in 1965 through the generous bequest of the Noble Foundation and Robert H. Hinckley. The Institute is dedicated to teaching students respect for practical politics and the principle of citizen involvement in government. The Hinckley Institute offers paid internships to students of all majors here locally, in Washington, D.C., and in 55 countries around the globe. The Hinckley Institute also offers classes, the nation's only campaign management minor, week-long experiences to Washington, D.C., and over $70,000 in academic scholarships. We invite students to go next door to our website, www.hinckley.utah.edu, for more information. The title of today's forum is Decolonizing Settler Colonialism and Native Americans, Experience in the Mountain West, and is co-sponsored by the Peace Advocacy Coalition, Wasatch Coalition for Peace and Justice, Tanner Center for Human Rights, University of Utah, Utah Valley University Peace and Justice Studies at Salt Lake Community College, School of Humanities and Social Sciences, the Salt Lake City Public Library, and Utahns for a Just Peace in the Holy Land. Our guest today is Leo Kilsback, Assistant Professor of American Indian Studies at Arizona State University. He is a citizen of the Northern Cheyenne Nation of southeastern Montana. Kilsback grew up on the Northern Cheyenne Indian Reservation, and he culturally and spiritually identifies himself as a Cheyenne person. Kilsback earned a doctorate degree in American Indian Studies with emphases on tribal government, tribal law, federal Indian law, and American Indian culture and spirituality. His dissertation, entitled The Chief's Prophecy, The Destruction of Original Cheyenne Leadership During the Critical Era, 1876 to 1935, is an epic of the history of Northern Cheyenne leaders, governance, and leadership systems. Written from a Cheyenne-centered perspective, his work uses traditional Cheyenne philosophies and oral traditions, as well as decolonizing theories to track the sources of modern tribal leadership and government problems specific but not isolated to the Northern Cheyenne. Please join me in welcoming our guest, Professor Leo Kilsback.
That introduction. There's two different, I guess, schools of thought when talking about colonization. One school of thought likes to focus on this idea that humans are just naturally pre-programmed to take the lands and the resources of other human beings. And I don't like that. I don't like that that school of thought, because it pretty much damns all human beings to be in colonizers if they could. And there's a lot of literature that has been written about this, mainly in fields of anthropology, and folks like Jared Diamond, who emphasize this theory. The other school of thought is more practical and focuses on actual events and the reality, basically tracking how lands are colonized, how lands are taken, how it's justified in the culture. And I tend to move more towards this school of thought, because throughout history there's always a track record of how lands are taken by another group of people. And knowing school, we tend to believe that the colonization of Native America, for example, just happened because one group of people were technologically superior to another, when in fact colonization has a long history that actually predates 1492. Some basic definitions before I continue on this slide presentation. Colonization simply means to inhabit or to migrate, for a group of people to migrate from one area to another land, typically at the expense of the indigenous peoples and indigenous populations. And colonization, after that initial move, can take on other forms, whether it's subjugating the indigenous populations, enslaving them, and expanding even further. Settler colonialism is an idea that the foreign family units move into an area to settle under the consent of an imperial force. Not this doesn't necessarily mean that the imperial force and the settlers are the same nationality. It could mean it's sort of a concept that I think a lot of folks don't necessarily have a complete understanding of. I myself struggle with it from time to time because I think it sometimes falls in the category of the accidental colonial colonialist agenda that I outlined earlier, that school of thought. The idea is that the lands were left vacant. How were they left vacant? Typically by a because the peoples were annihilated. And there's open land, and all of a sudden they people can settle it. Decolonization, obviously, is the effort to expel the colonial peoples and their institutions from indigenous lands and indigenous cultures. Because depending on the extent of colonization, whether it was just the taking of land or whether it was the taking of an actual identity, which happened with American Indians, decolonization for different groups of people means different things. I know we'd like to think that decolonization in Native America means regaining lost land. I think that's, not a practical way to look at decolonization, but it should be something that's maybe on the table, maybe at a later date. But I think for American Indians, decolonization means a reclamation of identity, reclamation of language and culture, spiritual practices, things that have been lost throughout the process of colonization. If we track the history of colonization, one of the first peoples and areas to be colonized, of course, is in Virginia, the Powhatan people. And this confederacy was a large confederacy comprised of about 33 different tribal nations, population of about 21,000. Powhatan, the confederacy, was actually at the center of this. And, of course, the chief was named, I'm not going to try to say that name, but like the Europeans, they just called him Chief Powhatan. And of course, his daughter was Pocahontas, and her legacy lives in our imaginations as this beautiful tale of a young Indian princess who was actually 9 years old at the time that John Smith landed. And their people were annihilated through a very brutal, violent process where the Indian people had never seen type of warfare where women and children were massacred indiscriminately. So their kingdom, or chiefdom, if you can see where Washington, D.C. is, stretched in these lands and these areas. Of course, then during this time period, the colonial imperial force was the English crown. There was no United States. There was no 13 colonies yet. So at this point, this is part of settler colonialism because the settlements that were set up were people who were of English descent, but they were not necessarily an independent people, the group that we now know as Americans. And in this area, the Wampanoag area, there was a coalition of tribes who were met by another group of English settlers named the Pilgrims, who were ironically escaping religious persecution. And they sort of met the same fate, meaning that the brutal and violent wars that had occurred in the taking of these lands followed a process that actually predates the age of exploration. These were settlers, and it was settler colonialism, because the imperial power at the time, of course, was the English, the English crown. And throughout the development of, I guess, New England, various colonies began to assert their claims to indigenous people's lands, and in an effort to expand their territory, all under the support of the imperial force, which is why I'm a little apprehensive when talking about settler colonialism with a Native American experience, because they were all supported by the imperial forces. And they, even though they weren't independent, of course, as the years progressed and the population of the, quote, Native Americans, meaning Americans who were the settlers who were born in America, a new identity was formed, they wanted independence. But until that point, the English had asked themselves questions from time to time if it was morally right to occupy and inhabit the lands of Indian people, basically questioning their own colonizing process. And John Northrop, he had this idea, introduced this idea in his writings. A lot of this text is recorded by Professor Robert Williams Jr. in his writings. He had this idea of vacuum domicilium, which means that at one point all human beings owned land, but when cattle came, humans started to fence the land. And because of fences, that meant they acquired this idea of ownership. Indians didn't fence land, nor did they, quote, improve it, nor did they put animals on it. So therefore, by his reasoning, because Indians didn't have fences, they didn't have a concept of ownership, something that's still in debate today that you may hear about. So it's okay to take their land and fence it off. Roger Williams, some 2 years later, because, you know, they didn't have internet, took them a while to get the memo. He said, neither the king nor the pilgrims have the right to the land. Indian owned the lands. Indian have boundaries. They trade on land. In fact, he says that Indians know where the boundaries are based on landmarks. And he made these two points, that land was not vacuum domicilium, and that the English took part in the racial, took land based on racial and religious superiority. And so this debate continued. A year later, Winthrop pulls out the God argument. If God is not pleased, then why does he drive the natives before us? Why does he decrease them and increase us? Why does he make room for us? If we have no right, God does, and who are we to question God? So you can see how these conversations may have quickly come to an end as soon as someone brings up the idea of religion. One of the things that the English people have, the English colonization that they had affirmed to some degree, was that land transfers occurred between two sovereigns, the English crown and Indian tribes, meaning that tribes had authority. They were sovereign entities, and that they could transfer land. So we have the birth of the 13 colonies, and then we have the American Revolution. I watched Mel Gibson last night on TV, The Patriot. He helped expel the brutal English, murderers and stuff. So I was surprised because there's a lot of Indian nations that were on both sides of the Revolutionary War. What about all this empty land here? Well, it's contested land. Indians were trying to protect what land they had left. They had actually had a lot of land left. And so at this point, the idea of settler colonialism shifts because the United States gains independence. It becomes itself an imperial power, not under the English crown. So what do? Well, they do what they've learned. What they learned to do from the English. Take Indian people's land, burn villages, burn towns, and Indian people did have towns, burn crops, and start claiming land for themselves. And so you see this new wave of colonization occurring under the United States government, the new and improved free nation. The Northwest Territory in particular was this gateway to the Great Lakes, vast resources of animals and plants and farmland. And there was an Indian resistance that sort of still today goes unnoticed. St. Clair's defeat, for example, is sort of forgotten in time, but he had about 1,700 soldiers who were annihilated. by an Indian coalition. We don't like to hear about those stories. We like to hear about the defeats. For example, Tecumseh's war and his second wave, the second wave of violence that came through his land. He was just a young man, but he became a prominent leader in trying to unite the nations, Indian nations, to try to protect these areas. During this time period, the famous Johnson versus McIntosh Supreme Court case came about. The idea was that two non-Indians had purchased the same piece of land, one from the Indians and one from the United States government. The question was, who had the authority to sell the land? It went all the way to the United States Supreme Court, and the answer to this question is, it's a big deal. The holding by Chief Justice John Marshall had said in his opinion that Indians do not have the right to sell their land. This is a mechanism that's used to justify colonization of Indian people's land. How can the people who have lived on the land do not have no right to sell their own land? So he ruled in favor of the person who bought the land from the government. Indians do not own it, therefore they cannot sell it. The doctrine of discovery states that all land discovered belongs to the discovering Christian nation. Do you remember when Christopher Columbus landed and planted a flag on Hispaniola and read some document? That's what he was doing. Created this new reality, this new mindset, where if as soon as you land as a Christian nation, you can proclaim huge swaths of land based on this Christian, this archaic medieval doctrine. It actually comes from 1513 when they were trying to figure out what to do with the colonizing parts of Mexico. And the legacy of that actually stretches further back to the Crusades, when the Christian armies were invading Muslim territory. How do you justify it? Well, you can claim it, because I guess, you know, they weren't Christian. So the reason was that Britain discovered America, claimed all Indian land, pretty much claimed all of America. The United States revolted against England. The United States gained Britain's land after the Revolution. And now the United States is a new discovering Christian nation. Very interesting. Led to the Indian removal, the south eastern area of the United States, where thousands upon thousands of Indians were killed during this process. And these were Indians who had adopted the plantation lifestyle, developed writing, developed newspapers, and had written constitutions, and owned slaves, and actually bought into this lifestyle, assimilated, if you will, even practiced Christianity. But it wasn't good enough. They had to be removed because the land was lush, and they were Indian, and they didn't own their land. So when we take a look at the United States, we come to the area where we are, Utah, and the area where I'm from, in Montana, the Louisiana Purchase. Some French guy, by the principles of the Doctrine of Discovery, claimed all this land just because he set foot on it and sold it to the United States. You guys ever hear that story about the Louisiana Purchase? The United States would spend the next 100 years killing Indians, claiming land that they had already bought. Okay, interesting land swindle. But the famous Lewis and Clark expedition, with that, they came through the United States, commissioned this group to go through this country and look for Indians who would cooperate and proclaim their sovereignty. Now, while all this is going on, there are Indian nations that are like, what? You're talking about doctrine of discovery? You're talking about we're in a state of pupillage, we're wards to the government, you can remove us, you have authority over us? Stuff that had already done to the eastern tribes. And these tribes are like at the height of their civilization, pretty much. Horse cultures. where at any moment they could annihilate Lewis and Clark and kill them because they're telling all these lies about some white guy back east who made some ruling that Indians don't own land, right? So this is a part of history, and if you get into the mindset of this time period, it's kind of hard to understand that type of thinking. If you get into the Indian perspective, you can see why Indian people were like, we don't understand what you're talking about. If you have a nation and you want to broker a treaty, let's do that. And so this started a wave of treaty brokering. Everyone remembers this, should remember this idea of the manifest destiny. This, is her name, Columbia? She's going through and paving the way for these settlers to settle on this land. You can't settle on land that's Indian land, so you're going to need an imperial force, in this case the United States, to subdue the indigenous populations there. Here's a nice image of the Oregon Trail. Some folks just wanted to get through and go to California. Other folks wanted to set up a permanent homeland. Numerous battles and forts were set up in this area for this contested land. So the imperial force obviously has a presence. They're no longer redcoats of the English, they're bluecoats of the United States. And this is the history that I think fascinates Americans the most. Cowboys and Indians, you know, sitting in a little house on a prairie, this kind of culture, the horse culture. And I like this map here, because it shows how the progress of taking Indian land had a lot of these land areas, they are excuse me, they're treaty lands between the Indian tribes and the United States government. There's something like 666 treaties between the United States and Indian tribes, and I think the United States held up about maybe two of them, and they later reversed their decisions on those ones anyway. So you can see the lands that were once Indian people's lands. This is the West. And during this era, right here, we had an allotment process take place where, because the Indian nations were subdued militarily, they could be, the reservation lands were opened up to settlement. They were allotted because they wanted to assimilate Indian people. And each Indian person got an allotment to farm it, to cultivate it, to, I guess, put a fence around it, right? And, any surplus land was opened up for settlement. So if I was a BIA agent here, I would obviously give Indians the poor land, the stuff you can't farm anyway, and then open it up to my family and my friends to settle this pristine land. And so, which is why you have a lot of reservations that are checkerboarded. And you had some, you know, here's the Oklahoma land office. You had some, they had fun with it. They had land rushes where you go in and you get a ticket, and folks like Tom Cruise and Nicole Kidman, can you guys watch that Far and Away? And go get some Indian land for free for a couple dollars, you know, and set up their legacy. Now, here's an image of a land rush. And so with this comparison has been made, of the loss of land, Indian land in Native America has been compared with the loss of Palestinian land since the Zion movement in 1946. There's a lot of differences. I mean, we like to see similarities in images, but there's a lot of differences that I think we shouldn't take this as simple as, you know, just the images. But don't get me wrong, the violence that's been taking place in this area is serious, and I think Indian people had endured this, and I mean, I know we have, but this is sort of an ongoing dispute. What hasn't taken place, or what hasn't been discussed more in more detail, is the second wave of colonization, which isn't just taking people's land, but it's taking their identity. And I think there are only three countries with a legacy, the legacy of boarding school experiences: United States, Canada, and New Zealand, or Australia. They took Indian children and pretty much brainwashed them, kidnapped them. The purpose, law scholars write about this, the purpose is to cover up the lie that they are indigenous, cover up the truth that their land was stolen and their people were murdered. And so they're forced into these boarding schools, and or the parents would go to jail. Thousands of kids for an entire generation, for I'd say two generations, were forced into these schools. And these boarding schools aren't the type of boarding schools that your parents went to, your non-Indian parents went to, where like, well, I had a bad boarding school experience. No, these were Indian boarding schools. Totally different system at work here. Stamp of approval by the politicians of the time, who believed that that was the only good thing to do for Indian people because they were living in poverty, and this other group of people wanted to kill them. So what do? We assimilate them. Carried on until the 1970s, and the residual effects still remain with our people. Sexual abuse, physical abuse, psychological abuse, a complete loss of identity. A lot of these children, their spirits are broken forever, which is why when they return to the reservation with these ideas and that were forced in their mind, and they can't fit in. And so what do they turn to? They only know a violent lifestyle that they grew up in. They can't be effective parents. How are you supposed to function? This leads to an increase in alcoholism, despair, contributes to the poverty, contributes to the dysfunction. And of course, in these boarding schools, there was always a religious, teachings along with, you know, this way of living. And I don't think any other, when you compare colonization of other people, if you see it as a, you know, the old school of thought, the other school of thought who says that it's just a natural human occurrence, there are very few human occurrences where a group of people actually takes their children and doesn't kill them, but sort of twist their minds, you know, except for the ones that I had mentioned. Canada, United States, and Australia. So we have our current Indian reservations here. We are in Utah. Here's the Northern Cheyenne right there. And you can see that back east, there's like almost no reservation. There's like no, there's nothing. All the reservations were extinguished. And an effort to sort of help Indian people in 1934, the United States government passed the Indian Reorganization Act to sort of help Indian people, become self-governing. After two generations of assimilation, and after more than two or three generations of genocidal wars, the United States says, now you can be, you know, free. But the system of governance that they wanted to sort of, well, they basically forced upon Indian people was a system that modeled off of a corporate structure, because that's the only thing that Americans at the time period could understand. Well, what's small enough, but what can function in our system? What can be democratic? Well, let's model these Indian tribes the same way that corporations are modeled after. And I found this off the internet. If you're not part of the solution, there's good money to be made in prolonging the problem. Because those historical injustices and problems have not been resolved. The effects of the genocidal wars, the effects of boarding schools have not been healed. And so you try to get a people to function and handle their own affairs and money when you've, for the past 200 years, you've been forcing this idea of paternalism on them and this idea that they're inferior. You can't change that overnight, which is why there's a lot of tribes who are are very dysfunctional. And tribes are diverse. This is a good map, you know. I like it because it shows the differences in location, but also that each tribe was as different from another as they were linguistically and culturally as Greeks were to Chinese or African nations. And yet this system of governance under the Indian Reorganization Act was to say, all you Indian people are going to follow this system and we're going to be fine and happy and we're just going to move on into the future. And when the Afghanistan conflict arose and they wanted to install a new system of government, I and several other Indian scholars were kind of like, well, are they going to model it off of the IRA? Because it makes as much sense to tell a country that is as diverse as this country to follow one mode of thinking, to follow one way of political thought, political theory, which they didn't generate themselves. And for us to say that it is part of freedom, it's part of democracy. So no wonder why there's dysfunction in these areas. Another area that's related to colonization in this new wave, the modern wave of colonization, is the threat to natural resource extraction. A lot of these Indian lands that were poor in terms of they couldn't be farmed, they sit on top of large reserves of oil, and gas, and coal. And now the push has been, since I was a young lad, has been to extract those resources from Indians and Indian tribes. And we also have the threat of this Keystone pipeline that's coming through traditional lands of the Cheyenne and Arapaho and Lakota peoples and Pawnee and Kiowa. That's not our reservation land, but our people know that that's our land, spiritually and culturally, historically. It's been our land longer than it's been anyone else's. So we join the fight to protect these places. Of course, there's a lot of controversy surrounding this Keystone Pipeline, which led a lot of folks to march on Washington, Indian folks, usually led by traditional leaders who aren't necessarily the political leaders who function under this IRA system of government, because traditional Indian people still perceive that as a form of assimilation. It's another map of our traditional homelands. And we have today this going on in Syria and Iraq, the presence of a terrorist group, the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, doing what they think is best for them, a very violent, militant, extremist group who is murdering and killing their own people for an ideology that I think we should take a step back and think about it for a while. If you were in this area and an imperial force forced its military might on your people with violence, and you did this, they did this for an entire generation, and you grew up in this generation, wouldn't that sort of warp your sense of the world? Wouldn't that sort of change how you perceived what is yours and what is theirs? So I'm really careful when I talk about this type of, it could be argued as a movement of decolonization. I'm very careful because I have friends and relatives who are fighting in armed forces that fought for the armed forces, for our United States. But it's just interesting to see that we're so quick to forget about our role that may have contributed to this extremism and to this violence. And I think back to the violence that was being committed during the colonization of Native America. What extremes did Indian tribes do? And so, with these ideas, you know, I spoke very generally and tried to reach a number of topics. I myself am a scholar of American Indian Studies, and it is our job to sort of sift through these theories and concepts that may be foreign to us, that maybe they come from somewhere else, and to extract and find our own theories and our own concepts and how we saw colonization and how we see decolonization. It's not an easy task because of the effects of colonization and assimilation. Our people are suffering, and yet it seems like we kind of, for the most part, don't see it as suffering. We just see it as sort of living, surviving, getting by. A lot of Indian communities are in shambles. And when I was a young man, I believed that the older generation of people were taking care of this, and they were working on it. And as I got older, I realized, well, some are, but they're lone warriors. For the most part, you know, it's a hard job. It requires a lifetime of work, which is something that I had dedicated myself to. Decolonization for the Cheyenne people is still undefined. We still don't know what we want. We think we want our language back. We think we want our culture back. And I think a lot of Indian tribes go through this. But I think if it comes down to it, I think a lot of us would rather not, because of the effects of colonization. Our minds have been changed so much. We've been accustomed to a way of thinking and living that gives us comfort. Decolonization, as I mentioned before, should involve, at least to some degree, the return of traditional lands. Because scholars like Taggy Alfred mentioned that longing for a home, that longing for a place to belong, is one of the worst feelings that indigenous people have, they suffer from. If you're from China or you're from England and you come to the United States, you have a homeland. You can go back. You can learn the language and the customs. For Indian people, that happened here. And so our struggle is that much more intense and that much more painful a lot of times. Okay. So with that, I leave this last slide of a sunrise, my homeland on the plains. Every morning is perceived in our culture as a new beginning. You wake up with the sunrise. You help the sun up. It helps you up for something new, something positive. The day is over. The night's over. You can be a different person. In fact, you are supposed to. You're supposed to make yourself at least one promise of that day. And by the time the sun sets, you can ask yourself, did I keep my promise? And this is all done in prayer, in solidarity with the supernatural. At one point, it was done with our entire nation. But with that, I'll end that, and I'll entertain any questions. I hope.
Thank you for your talk. Is this on? Okay. I have two questions. They're rather diverse. One question is why do so many Native Americans participate in the U.S. military? And the other question is right now there's a big push in the western states for the state governments to take over federal land, which kind of is another colonization process of, or it seems to be a colonization process, maybe towards further privatization of land. So I know they're two completely different topics, but maybe you could address both.
Well, the military, during an early reservation period, the only way for a Indian youth to become a man, well, traditionally, was to engage in some form of physical activity. Hunting and warfare on the plains were the popular forms of attaining manhood. Something changes in the spirit, and you can imagine why your nephew or your son wants to play football and why they enjoy it, that same rush. Warfare on the plains was much different. When the reservations were established, and Indian people were bound from doing anything, even initiation ceremonies, the military became the one thing that they could do. They could become a scout for the United States government. And that carried through throughout the colonization of the rest of America, because there were Indian scouts that were present at places like, even like Wounded Knee. And that carried through World War I, World War II, you know, Korea, you know, Vietnam, Iraq I, Iraq II, Afghanistan, and it's still present. Our people are still holding on to this this concept of manhood. And I think if we decolonize ourselves and we start to reintroduce these old philosophies of Indian manhood and ceremonies that help foster the growth of a man, we'll begin to part our way from this mainstream Western ideology of what it means to be a soldier. But you got to remember, for two generations, those ceremonies and those ways of thinking were destroyed. So it takes that much effort to regain that. And as far as the privatization of federal lands, I think it is another wave of colonization, if you want to call it that. I don't think it's, to me, I believe it's something that is gonna happen, because that was the practices of the United States government and the private sector from the beginning. A lot of Indian land that was taken, or allowed to be taken, was allowed to be taken by the federal government. And a lot of that land became, you know, went into private ownership for the benefit of individuals to gain wealth on the resources in whatever ways they can exploit it. So I hope that answers your question.
Just a follow-up, are there any...
Wait, there's a question. Let's take this one back to the line. Sorry.
So I really enjoyed your presentation, and thank you for coming to Utah and sharing your work. And I just wanted to also say thank you for your dedication. You know, there's not a lot of Indigenous people out there dedicating their lives to this conversation, which I think is hugely important. So, and I was just down at ASU Friday, so good to see you up here. So my question is, like, what has happened in Canada? You know, there was a national acknowledgement and an apology to Indigenous people across Canada, where the federal government, you know, apologized to the Native people, First Nations people there. And one of the big movements in Canada has been to give back land back to some of the tribes and some of the areas. And I guess with your knowledge, I mean, I would hope maybe someday the United States is going to move towards that. But do you, I guess, see that happening, or is there any work being done, you know, towards that same kind of movement that Canada and First Nations has done? I mean, there's a lot of similarities.
Yes, there are a lot of similarities, and a lot of the fights that the Canadian First Nations folks had sort of won. They were, you know, they began in the 50s, and they continue on because the status of First Nations Indians is much different than the status of American Indians here, where we have a lot more sovereignty, but a lot less, I'd say, leadership. In Canada, you have a lot more leadership and a little less to work with when it comes to government relations. I think that there has been a lack in pursuing movements and change for a number of reasons. Colonization, obviously, the continued effort to subdue Indian people's minds through the educational system, but also in America, we have this weird process of where Indian people are still looking at the table of the colonizers, and they want a piece of that. In Canada, a Canada student of mine, a Canadian First Nations student of mine, said that Canadians don't see it that way. They see it as if they're recreating a new table for them, so they can meet this imperial power one on one. And I think Indian people in our everyday lives, we don't realize that we're sort of fueling that mentality of we want a piece of that table. And America does the mainstream American system of media and culture does a very good job in making it a very seductive, that we should want this, you know, we need this, when in fact, maybe Indian people, could say, maybe we don't need that. So I hope that answers your question, but that's something that's a lot more, requires a lot more work and effort. And I welcome anyone who's, and friends with anyone who is an advocate of peace and justice. So thank you.
Hi, my name is Enoque Freile. I'm an undergraduate student here at the U. And thank you for your talks. It was really interesting to listen to. One of my questions was, you've mentioned about a couple of treaties, if not a lot of treaties, been broken over the past couple of years. I also have a friend who's actually part of the whole Hawaiian community out in Hawaii, and there's a treaty out there that's also been broken. So I was kind of the treaty about trying to keep Hawaiian lands in Hawaiian hands type of thing. And so my question is, has there been anything done towards the whole treaty or promises that's been broken, or is it just keeps rolling over type of thing?
I think, and thank you for that. I'm aware of the treaty in Hawaii and the struggle. Obviously, there's major differences, but a lot of similarities. Indian tribes have sort of forgotten treaties, and in the same manner that America has forgotten treaties. Because every time I talk about treaties, or when I was younger, I used to talk about treaties, they'd say, why are you Indians talking about this treaty? It's a thing of the past. You guys get over the thing of the past. And I was like, this treaty is after the United States Constitution, and after all these events that are taking place, in America, we just love our Constitution, but you're saying that the treaties are isolated, they're a thing of the past, and the Constitution isn't? And so Indian people have sort of adopted that perception through the colonizing process. And so if you go to a tribal government and you talk to them about treaty rights, a lot of them see it as a thing of the past, something that's archaic, something that is not necessarily, that doesn't apply to their current situation. What happens at the grassroots level, however, is that there are organizations who create treaty councils, and they say, we base our sovereignty off of these treaties, not off of the IRA Constitution, which is really a delegated power. The government says, we're allowing you to do this. The treaties, they come from a different concept of sovereignty, something that's inherent. The leaders, they didn't get their permission to be leaders from someone else. Well, they did, but it's more spiritual in nature, more cultural, more ceremonial. And I think in the decolonizing process, as we begin to decolonize ourselves and our minds, we will begin to look at these treaties in a different light, in a manner that isn't akin to this idea that Indians are a thing of the past and therefore treaties are a thing of the past. And there are treaty councils out there who are doing very well in terms of activism work. Thank you. Appreciate that.
Hello. Good afternoon. I really enjoyed your presentation as well. Treaties. I'll define treaties for you. It's a good broken promise, as your grandpa would say. It's good toilet paper. It's as fine as the toilet paper it's printed on.
We call it toilet paper treaty paper, right?
Yeah, that's why we got it, the TP paper. In case you're unaware, I've been around in this Omakawaniatu, and first of all, forgive me, all my elders, forgive me. And thank you for your presence as well, and thank you for the knowledge that you handed down to me this far. Who in Lakota? My name is Shunkmanitu Tanka Ishawichayuta. So, there's a lot of power in that, only to the people who understand it. But in this other name, my name is English way, it's Marty. It's no power in there. But I met with an elder once on the Semena Nation, a real traditional elder, very, very. And because I met with a lot of elders, I don't really go around and talk about it a lot, you know. But just an understanding is, and the Seminole Nation has never ever touched a pen. Never, ever. They're the only nation here in the whole United States nation in there that never touched a pin. They're never, never defeated. The truth of their identity went back into the swamps. When the white government came to our land, my grandpa's, our Lakota land, Lakota Makocha, if you get back on that map, and you can see the colonization of the maps that you've seen, all that beautiful brown territory, all that beautiful area that where there was a good balance, and as it came and as it got taken out. But as you can see where the land allotments came down, you can see the path of the iron horse coming through. And the way it was explained to me is we're through that iron horse, and as a matter of fact, that gentleman sitting over there holding up the books over there, I don't know if it's a dictionary, a Bible, or a law book, but that man right there, he killed a lot of my people for this thing called America, in case you're wondering. They said that when he was done with coming to the Great Sioux Nation, it looked like a bunch of dead eagles laying all over the place. That's how much chiefs he killed. They got so much chiefs killed that... Now all the eagle feathers are all over in museums. But that's another part of decolonization and colonization for one way of life to live. So one thing that I am trying to understand here, if it is so-called a treaty, then why isn't it so that... If we understand one another's, how is it going to be with the spirituality, with the aspect? How is it, because the reason why I'm having trouble over with it right now is because to my nation, to the Lakota Nation, to the law, to the land, we're having people come from all over the world now. With they have more eagle feathers than us. They have, and it's just, we're really being misrepresented and really mislooked at. I guess a really good question I have is, who am I? Lehantuke, lewa shichu hel wa epkhwa wa wa chin ash lewa wicho uchich akap wa kishni hona hanie nilak hotalo. Be careful, which tell your elders to not touch the pin right away. Tell your people to look at all of their aspects, because in this one, they touch this pin, this white man's going to come. So everything that you have good in your land, all those wonderful children, it's not your only your language, their language, all of that's going to go. It's going to be like this over here. And when I'm a kocha kikile, I am a true, I could say that I am a keeper of the land. I have really beautiful land. I don't want nobody to go there. But I welcome humans with really good, wonderful hearts. I have black people, yellow people, white people, red people coming to the land. And it's so beautiful when they all come there with a purity of a heart and they could leave it like that. And so, but I'm a caretaker of this land. That's all I am. And I have a little piece of land that is very, very beautiful. And on my land, you could come there and you could see the eagles and the deer and the bobcats and you could smell the Mother Nature. You could hear the Bigfoots. You could see UFOs. You could see spirits walking the land. And none of these and nothing. So I guess I just wanted to say that. I'm really proud that I took part of this. Mm. Thank you. It just really takes me back. Thank you.
I think that's all the time we have. I'd like to... Is that all the time? Yeah. So, do you want
to... Well, I was just going to say thank you so much for all of your wonderful questions, and if you guys could please join me in thanking Professor Lee Kilsback for an excellent and informative forum. Thank you so much. Thank you.
Thank you.